Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Have you ever wondered about taking a truly inspiring and rewarding trip to Israel? Or maybe you've already taken a trip, but you'd like to go a little bit deeper. Please join us. This is Michael Medved. We're leading a tour to Israel in September of 2019, and we want you to come along. It's under the auspices of Discovery Institute. It will cover both the Holy Land and the modern state, everything from high tech to ancient archaeology, and also with a real focus on the spiritual meaning and significance of what the state of Israel means. Come join us and find out all about it by going to discovery.org/Israel2019. I'm going to be going together with George Gilder on technology, Steve Meyer on science, and me, Michael Medved, talking about country and culture. Go to discovery.org/Israel2019.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. Today, my guest is Michael Newton Keyes, author of the new book Unbelievable, Seven Myths About the History and Future of Science and Religion. Keyes is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and a former Fulbright scholar. After earning a PhD in the history of science from the University of Oklahoma, he won research grants from such organizations as the National Science Foundation and the American Council of Learned Societies. Keyes currently serves as lecturer in the history and philosophy of science at Biola University and is on the board of directors at Ratio Christi, an alliance of apologetics clubs on college campuses. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah. So you've written this awesome book that debunks seven of the most popular and pernicious myths about science and religion. In this and other episodes, you're helping us take an in-depth look at each myth, where it comes from, why it persists, and the truth of the matter. So let's just jump right in. In chapter two, you ask, are Christians to blame for 1,000 years of dark ages?
Well, the very term dark ages doesn't sound very affirming of that period of time, does it, Andrew?
No, it really doesn't.
Like, how would you like, you know, your life described as dark, you know?
Right, I lived like in the dark ages.
Yes. So the technical name for that period is the medieval or middle ages. And even that's not like really, really great. It's kind of like if you live in Oklahoma, it's just okay, you know. So the Middle Ages were in the middle between the ancient world and the modern world. But they certainly weren't dark. I mean, the myth is used to make Christianity look like it is anti-rational because supposedly nothing of interest intellectually happened during the Middle Ages. So it's used as a way to stigmatize religious believers, particularly Christians, as not very helpful to, you know, producing culture and including science. That's how it's used.
And how is it used today?
Initially, right after what we call the Middle Ages, it was used just to say we're better than the guys right before us. But now it's used more in an ideological kind of a warfare sense of they're not really thinking chronologically now. They're thinking more, you know, we're on the right side of history. We're with science and you're on the wrong side of history. You're with religion. And look how religion screwed up science in the Middle Ages. That's kind of how it's used. So.
And in your book, do you give us examples of why this period wasn't actually a dark age?
Yeah. Now, I start with the acknowledgement that as Christianity grew out of late antiquity under Roman rule, Romans themselves didn't highly value science compared to Plato, Aristotle, and Ptolemy, who we talked about in the last episode. I mean, Romans had some science, particularly encyclopedias and did a few interesting things, but early Christians often absorbed this kind of so-so attitude towards science, but that was absorbing ambient culture, not a distinctive of Christianity. But clearly, as we move into the Middle Ages, Christians later created astonishingly science-friendly civilization called Europe. And St. Augustine is one of the pivotal figures writing around the year 400, so this is still kind of late antiquity, you know, right on the doorstep of the Middle Ages. He wrote that we should proceed, quote, by most certain reasoning or experience, unquote, to figure out how God made things. and how he made the nature of things. And that was a common medieval book title, was The Nature of Things. For example, Roger Bacon, this is not Francis, but this is the medieval Bacon, Roger Bacon in the 1200s, he studied light, and he started by reading what the Greek and Islamic authors said about it. So that would be looking at reasoning through other people's reasoning, but then directly to experience. And he actually did experiments on light and discovered some interesting things. But more importantly, for the long haul, was what Christians in the Middle Ages invented that helped to be a home, actually a permanent home for science, was the university. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, the university was a Christian invention. They were all Christian to begin with. And the church didn't micromanage these institutions. They let them have quite a bit of freedom to manage themselves. And they were highly successful. There were hundreds of thousands of people being educated in science, particularly in the late Middle Ages. So these were not dark ages after all.
Right. So this period actually included time that would pave the way for the Enlightenment and our time.
Yeah, scientific revolution, Enlightenment, so on. And they developed some of the basic methodology and reasoning tools for science, like, for example, a logic that's friendly to science rather than just the mathematical sort of logic. Then they encouraged human dissection and gave actually theological reasons why it should be permissible for the sake of knowledge.
Yeah.
And the very idea of laws of nature is rooted in the Middle Ages and late antiquity because of the Christian idea that you got a lawgiver, God, and so we should expect to find rationally structured laws that are intelligible to the human mind. And hey, looks like we've discovered a few, huh?
Yeah. So not dark after all. That's nope. Awesome. Well, in chapter 3, you ask, did medieval Christians believe in a flat earth? You show they didn't, despite the common misconception. How is this false story related to the Dark Ages myth?
This is the biggest specimen of sort of, you know, exhibit A of what the Dark Ages are supposed to be about. You know, so ignorant that they believed the earth was flat. So I break it out into a different chapter because there's so much really interesting material about this sort of subset of the Dark Ages myth. So last episode we covered what I called the big myth. A big universe is a problem for Christianity. Nope. Then we covered the dark myth. And now we're covering the flat myth. So how's that a way to remember it, Andrew?
Yeah, that's a great way. So what is the true story of the history of ideas about Earth's shape?
Well, in the ancient world before Christianity, Greek philosophers or natural philosophers, what we would roughly call scientists, they, of course, had great arguments that the Earth is round, not flat. And those arguments made their way through late antiquity, through the Middle Ages. I'll give you one example of one of those. So you look up during a lunar eclipse. That's when the Earth's shadow cast up onto the moon covers up or eclipses the face of the moon. And the edge of that shadow is curved, suggesting that it's projected by a round object, Earth. So medieval students in universities were routinely educated in these kinds of arguments. So the knowledge of Earth being round was not lost to the Dark Ages, as Neil deGrasse Tyson claims, and was rebuked by one of his Twitter followers, of all things. So it was a little embarrassing for Tyson, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, most of us were taught that Europeans thought Earth was flat until Columbus in 1492. What's wrong with that?
The real debate when Columbus was trying to get funding for his trip was not the shape of the Earth, it was the size of the Earth. And that truly was debatable. Columbus was trying to make the argument that it was smaller than others thought, and also that the ocean was shorter in relation to land masses. And that was truly debatable. But the shape of the Earth was a no-brainer, that this knowledge was available throughout the medieval period. And the sailors on the boat were not afraid of falling off the edge of the ship. They were afraid of the oceans being too big and dying of starvation or vitamin D deficiency or something like that. So that was what was going on in the time of Columbus.
Huh. So how is the flat myth used today in the debate about contemporary versions of Darwinian evolution?
I'll give you a little story. I once testified before the State Board of Education in Texas about when the school board was debating what sort of science standards they should adopt. And I argued in favor of presenting scientific arguments for the neo-Darwinian viewpoint as well as those against. And there were some demonstrators in the hallways and around that were wearing archaic clothing and were passing out posters claiming that anyone who doubted Darwin or presented scientific arguments against Darwin, contemporary Darwinism, that they were like flat earthers, and what they were asking for public schools was to have equal time between, you know, teaching that the earth is flat versus the earth is round. And of course, that's totally ridiculous. And it's, but what they had on their poster was a picture of a ship sailing over the edge of the ocean. And they're saying, if you want to have such poor science policy, you're like a flat earther, like those stupid Christians in the Middle Ages. Ironically, they got the history completely wrong. And they're supposed to be pro-education. And yet this myth that's still in grammar schools today, and sometimes middle school and above, they are, ironically, they're perpetuating bad education as Darwin-only advocacy folks. So I had a good laugh over that one.
Yeah, and that's a great story and a great example of how just insistent these myths can be, and how they kind of join into the story of science. And, you know, if you don't know any better, you're just going to pick it up and run with it. So the flat earth myth we see still around today, is that the biggest one in your opinion, or is the best still to come?
Oh, I've got some real juicy ones coming later, but I guess you're going to have to wait on that.
Okay. Well, thanks for your time again, Mike. In other episodes, you'll take us deeper into the other myths that you address in your book, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks for visiting, Andrew.
Yeah, no worries. Well, you can get your own copy of Unbelievable by Michael Keyes by inquiring at your favorite bookstore or shopping online. I won't mention any particular sites. You can find more of the conversations we're having with Michael at idthefuture.com or search for ID the Future in your favorite podcast app. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott, and that was Michael Keyes. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.